Welcome to the 12th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free number anyone may call for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody followed by the number 8. If you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. The classic satire Candide lampoons the notion that this is the best of all possible worlds. You sure don't have to be a philosopher to think of a few ways things could be better. And as a rule, things don't get better unless somebody fights to make them so. In the next hour, we'll talk to a couple of old school organizers who have been homeless and are now fighting to end homelessness. They'll tell us how and how come right after this.
In terms of homelessness, there is at least one thing most everyone agrees on. For the more than 8,000 homeless in King County, there are not nearly enough shelter beds. Bill Hobson is executive director of the Downtown Emergency Service Center, an organization that provides services including shelter for homeless adults. He's on the front lines of the fight to provide shelter for the homeless.
The amount of shelter bed availability still is not nearly enough to address the needs of roughly 2,000 men, women, and children that are sleeping outside every night because they can't access shelter.
However, very few agree on where the more than 2,000 without shelter should go. While the issue is argued, every cold winter night, hundreds of homeless are turned away from shelters that have reached capacity, and hundreds of others have already resigned themselves to sleep outside. Instead of wasting their energy searching for an empty cot, they scour alleys, bridges, bushes, and greenbelts to find the best protection. Over 2,000 without shelter have to go somewhere, and for nearly 80 years, many found that somewhere to be a controversial place called the jungle. The jungle is in South Seattle and bordered by I-5 and Beacon Hill. It's 100 acres of dense ivy, muddy slopes, and hundreds of broadleaf maples at the end of their life cycle. A quick walk through and one will also find that it's a place filled with invasive freeway noise, rats, garbage, spent condoms, and human waste. Simon has been homeless for 13 years. He states that despite its deplorable living conditions, the jungle offers one feature highly valued by the homeless.
If they move up in there, they can do what they want without being interfered with by other people, mainstream society. They can go up there and practice their freedoms in the truest sense. You know, rugged individualism, I think you find up there.
The lack of rules and oversight makes the jungle appealing for the homeless, but this also makes it a target for frequent sweeps by the Beacon Hill community and local government. Craig Thompson lives in Beacon Hill, and just two short blocks from the jungle. Since 2000, he has been active in finding a way in which the homeless and his community can live harmoniously. He is keenly aware of the tough position communities like Beacon Hill are in because of the county's lack of appropriate shelter.
It's a dilemma that we're in right now because, on the one hand, we cannot allow, as a city, to have our woods be taken over by homeless encampments that then become criminalized. But on the other hand, we don't have a place for these folks to go.
Tent City, a self-governing mobile encampment, is an alternative. Communities tolerate Tent City because the roughly 100 residents must obey a strict code of conduct, with rules including no drugs or alcohol, no fighting, no panhandling, and no visiting tents of the opposite sex. It has not proven to be a perfect solution, however, because, like the jungle, the reason it appeals to one group is the same reason it repels another. Charles and Matt collect cans during the day, and most nights sleep in the jungle. They've tried out Tent City and have a very specific reason why they don't stay there anymore.
Why would somebody choose to live in the jungle as opposed to, let's say, Tent City?
What it is privacy.
We want to be left to hell alone.
For Charles and Matt, the lawlessness of the jungle is a catch-22. While ensuring they won't have anyone telling them what to do, it inevitably attracts dangerous people and situations.
There's bozos down there. There's enemy people down there.
Mm-hmm. You've seen guns. You've seen knives out there. You've seen people get beat up. I seen a girl out there naked. She was prostituting. And the guy was about to beat her up. And she was screaming for help. I had to go run over there to help her. She's running around.
You clobbered that guy. Yeah.
Jeez.
Given Charles and Matt's depiction of enemies, weapons, and violence, one might think it strange that anyone would choose to live in the jungle. All the homeless people I talked to expressed that they would spend as little time as possible there. Most people without a home, a family, or shelter just want to find a place where they can rest.
You get people down there that just need a place to sleep, and they're just looking for somewhere to go. And sometimes they approach me or something like that. They're always asking, you know, certain questions. What can I do? Where can I go? It's not easy down there. It's not easy down there living out in the weeds, having to find a place to sleep.
For One World Report, I'm Adam Vaughn.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Homelessness Marathon, where the numbers to call in are 877-NOBODY8 or 866 left out. Here with me in Pass Christian, Mississippi, where we're mostly talking about the aftermath of Katrina and the poverty that has been left in the storm's wake, are two of my favorite people, Paul Bowden, the director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, who's based normally in San Francisco, and Sherry Honkola, the director of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, who also founded the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia and is now based in Minneapolis. Sherry and Paul, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Happy to be here. Hey.
Well, it's great to have you both here, and I want to get some of this newfangled stuff is about Katrina, but we want to hear some of the ancient wisdom here about organizing. So let's talk about some of the things that are going on around the rest of the country. Now, Paul, as opposed to the people who are suffering here, dealing with the aftermath of Katrina, which is really quite horrific, we can be fortunate, right, that everybody in the San Francisco Bay Area is doing just fine.
You can believe that if you want. I think, though, what we're seeing here is the same thing that we see in other places. It's just much more extreme because of the more blatant the racism is and mm-hmm. because of the catastrophe of Katrina. But the inherent denial of social and human rights for people based on their economic status or based on their housing status or based on their skin color is pretty universal at this point in time throughout the United States.
Now, Paul, here we know why all the low-income housing got wiped out. It got wiped out because of Katrina. But you've had in San Francisco area and elsewhere in the country, a kind of slow storm called gentrification that wiped out a lot of low-income housing. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, I think that Katrina was the housing policies of the United States on speed. I don't think it you know, the housing was already being wiped out. Had we not wiped out affordable housing for poor people beginning in 1979 through 1983, when it went from $84 billion to $18 billion, that's in 2004 baseline figures, you know, had that not taken place, I think the ability for this country to respond to Katrina in an appropriate way, if we had maintained a belief system that housing is something that's good for everybody, regardless of their economic status, I think responding to Katrina would have been really different. So Katrina didn't cause the catastrophe and the racism and the brutality of what's going on now. It just exacerbated it. But it had started long before that.
Okay. And by the way, this hour is being heard in Canada as well. So I'd like to welcome all of our listeners in Canada who are tuning into the Canadian Homelessness Marathon. Sherry, we've been talking all night here, and we're going to bring our listeners up to speed a little bit about the local stuff. But we've been talking all night here about there just is no help here for the people who are suffering after Katrina, or it's not enough. It's just a lot of bureaucracy and not enough help. Is that the same as or different from the situation for poor people elsewhere in the United States?
Oh, boy, what a loaded question.
That's one way I'm loaded, and it's the only way.
Boy. You know, there's a lot of good people out there. There's a lot of volunteerism that's happening. But I think that the missing piece is this fight for basic economic justice. And volunteering is not going to be enough. We can't just, get out the hammers and the wood and the nails and that kind of thing. There's some, you know, bad guys that we're up against. This country has plenty, and there's no reason that the folks that are still in need of housing 3.5 years later after Katrina are in the situation that they're in. And there's certainly no reason why we have tons of homeless people across this country when we've got massive amounts of abandoned properties. So we think that the other thing that we need to be doing besides stepping forward and volunteering, we need to be calling out the bad guy and demanding that we begin to house people in this country.
Well, you know, I've written about this, and I've said that, you know, Katrina kind of shows both a left-wing and a right-wing point. The right-wing always says if the government gets out of the way, the people will do amazing things, and that's true. The people of this country will do amazing things, but the left-wing will tell you, without our own government helping us, we can't do enough, and it also proves that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And we're not going to have any choice. In the next couple of years, as soon as people get over the pill of denial that things are going to get better in the next couple of years because somehow our government is going to deliver us and everything's going to be better and we're going to have this massive recovery that's going to take place, we need to begin to build now, to build a massive army of low-income people that are tired of living in the situation that they're living in, and ensure that we shift the priorities of our country.
Those numbers to call in here on the Homelessness Marathon are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And let's take a call. Let's talk to Ken from Ithaca, New York. Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon, Ken.
Hello. How you doing?
Well, we're doing fine, I think.
Well, I've been enjoying talking to your show. I think it's doing a lot to get people to focus on important issues.
Well, thank you very much. What would you like to say other than that? You have a point you want to make about homelessness or poverty in the United States?
Well, I do. In fact, it kind of expands. I've had a poor stretch myself, but I've had some good fortune also. But it has to do with the question the woman just brought up, basic economic justice. I have a public access TV show here called Truth and Truthiness in Ithaca, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to bring up the ways in which the wealthy have been taken advantage and the ways in which the wealth has flowed from the poor to the wealthy.
Okay. And by the way, Ithaca, New York was the site of the very first homelessness marathon. And it is a fact that the income poles are shifting apart in this country. The rich are getting richer. It's a cliche, but that's the way it is. And the poor are getting poorer. What is your point about that, Ken?
Well, I earlier in the show, one, I value hearing the voices of our homeless and people who really have a problem with housing. But suppose we do, under the Obama administration, get up enough momentum, enough change of mind, enough political will to do some good public works. How do you respond to people who will then say this will be taken advantage of? People will just say, okay, this is good. And rather than make it a positive experience, is an experience in which, in fact, the efforts of people of goodwill do not really pan out as well as you might like.
Well, let me toss this to Paul and Jerry. Paul, you want to answer this question?
Well, I mean, if it's a public works project and somebody ain't doing their job, then I guess they get fired. But, you know, I have a kind of a problem with the premise behind it, that I think the question is, what is the role of government? I mean, when we talk about the government helping poor people with housing, we're not talking about the $150 billion a year that the government provides through tax credit programs and mortgage interest deduction programs, which overwhelmingly benefit higher income households. But that's not seen
exactly
as helping anybody. That's called economic stimulus. But when we talk about the $29 billion a year that the government shells out in funding for affordable housing for a much larger number of people that happen to be poor, somehow that's called charity and help. So I think the question is, do we want to live in a society that is governed under the premise that housing, healthcare, and education are important for everybody, regardless mm-hmm. of their wealth? Because we certainly give the tax breaks and we certainly give the benefits to people that can afford to pay for college, that can pay for housing. There's all kinds of economic benefits that are provided for families to be able to do that. But for those of us that don't have the means to be able to do that, somehow we're not seen as worthy, and anything we get is a scholarship or a subsidy. And it gets to the point that families are now being expected to sweep streets and do community service to get an emergency shelter bed because that's seen as providing them with help. When in fact,
but it's debilitating, Paul. I think you've got an excellent point, but it's debilitating and it weakens them. And I agree with you. It's really embarrassing that the wealthy in this country were able to effectively legalize steal $800 billion. You know, enough money to bankrupt the country. And as you say, we can't even get decent housing and can't get people medical care who are really in trouble.
Well, and I also think
how do you communicate to people? How do you get them to understand this? I mean, we've had 8 years of propaganda, anti-poor propaganda.
I'd say we've had more than 8 years. Let's not underestimate it. Sherry, you're an expert here. How do we counter this?
I think we don't stand around and wonder what they're going to think about it. I think we go forward and continue to organize on every single block, in every church, and in every synagogue, in rural communities, you name it. Because the bottom line is that this issue of homelessness is really just a paycheck away, a healthcare crisis away from everybody right now in this country.
Or a hurricane away.
Yeah. And you know, we just have to, you know, get out there and get organized. It's all about organization at this point.
Well, I agree. I mean, we got to get the momentum, and everybody's got to pitch in and organize. I 100% agree. But there are people out there that don't want to hear this, and there are bad guys out there that'll fight it and pay to put it down. So
you know,
we can also have a message, I think.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the sad thing is that we're all going down. And the thing is that many folks may still just be in denial. But I've been talking to many of those families across the country who had great jobs for 20, 25 years.
Oh, yeah.
And then all of a sudden have found themselves a part of this revolving door where they're going to lose their two-car garages, their two cars, their kids in college, and they just don't know how they're going to hold on to their homes at this point after they've lived there for 44 years. So the thing is that you can have one opinion for a long time, and then something can happen, and that's what's happening right now in this country.
Yeah.
Don't want to give out those numbers again to call in here on the Homelessness Marathon, 877-NO-BUDDY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Let me toss out a question. I know I've disagreed with people before about this one, but there is, to me, a balance. You know, I mean, there's one school of thought that says we've got to have massive organizing. My own school of thought is we've just got to have a fight somewhere that we win, just in the way that we got James Forman into Ole Miss. It took the National Guard, but, you know, once that battle was won and a couple other battles were won, school desegregation happened. You have to fight somewhere, you know. And so, Paul, Sherry, let me get your opinions about this. What is the right tactic here at this point? Because, really, we're losing ground. We're not gaining ground.
Well, I think at least what we're trying to do with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign is to do what other parts of the world are doing, to begin to see these things as human rights violations. Like when somebody dies because they don't have access to shelter, that should be seen as a human rights violation, and that's what we should call it. And we should see ourselves as human rights monitors. We should write it down. We should photograph it. We should talk about it. We should scream about it. But we should also begin to reclaim these basic human rights that are taken away from us. We can't just stand around begging in the halls of Congress to change things. And that's why we highly advocate the use of nonviolent civil disobedience to take back things like health care, like housing, like water, like land. Because, you know, the folks that are dying can't afford to sit and wait until laws are passed.
And I also think that those kids walking into that school wasn't the battle. That was the culmination of the battle, that the organizing had to take place before that event that you're talking about could happen. It didn't just come out of nowhere. It was building up over a long period of time with a lot of blood and effort. and energy that went into organizing in order to be able to make that happen. And that's really not us disagreeing at all. And I know that it was me and you that were having that discussion.
Well, I was trying to
night.
Keep your name out of it, Paul. But
I don't
care.
That's cool. It's all good. You know, it's a discussion. But you know, I also want, you know, the thing is, if people had not taken on those battles and those struggles and worried about what the white people would say about whether or not these kids could go to that school, then those kids would still today not be in that school. And we can't organize based on what they're going to say about us. That's how we ended up with charity being as a symbol of homelessness. And the pathetic images that nonprofits and for-profits and United Way and those dudes use to describe us as poor people is because they're worried about what they're going to say about us. We have to worry about what we say about us, and what poor people are saying about each other is much more relevant to making change than what other people are saying about us.
You know, I just want to say I agree with you. It's a discussion, but it's not an argument, because the fact is, if you organize poor people broadly enough, sooner or later you will be in a fight. And if you're in a fight, sooner or later you're going to need a lot of community support. The two are interwoven. On that note, Ken, I want to thank you very much. Sounds like you do a really good show. If I lived in Ithaca, I might be able to watch it.
Yeah, it's on Blip TV. You can stream it. Just go to Blip TV and stream Truth and Truthiness. And I just want to also thank you so much. I was so pleasantly surprised. I've been listening all day to see this on our public radio station. I think we need more of this. We need more changing of the public psychology and knowledge about homelessness.
Thank you very much for the call. Those numbers again to call in are 877-NOBODY8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And we have Terrence from Texarkana, Texas on the line. Terrence, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Oh, welcome. Thank you very much. I'm listening, and it seems to me the solution is, let me put it this way. No one in the United States could ever really retire in peace, because in order to retire, you still have to pay the tax on your land. So you're still enslaved by the government. You can't even retire without having to pay the master government in order to live. And that's the problem. The problem is government, and you have to pay for the privilege of being alive. In Arkansas, you have to pay taxes to buy food. Buying food in Arkansas is a privilege. Your guys' solution is more government or government action, when actually for government to distribute $100, it costs $5,000 for them to do it. There's no way that government is a solution. We've got to get government out of our lives, out of taxing property, which is basically to enforce prejudice. The higher property taxes, they can keep blacks, whites, lower income people out of different areas. That's all property taxes are. You've got to get the government out of the controlling of the people in order for the people to survive. The reason we're in this.
Well, Terrence, let me break in here, because I know you have a viewpoint that's a very dominant one, or has been a viewpoint that's a very dominant one. But, you know, if you shrink the government down, who's going to protect you against unsafe food? Who's going to be monitoring disease? I mean, who's got the resources to rebuild after Katrina if we don't have a government doing it?
Also, what gives you the right to own the land if the government didn't certify that you're the owner of the land? So you wouldn't actually have any right to that land if government wasn't taxing you by virtue of the fact that they give you the deed that then says you own it.
Well, Terrence, what's your solution? If you have no government, who's going to help? They're not. The government been doing precious little around here, and it's not enough.
And shouldn't we represent our government? Shouldn't we be government?
Well, anyway, we've given you a lot of questions, Terrence. What's your answer?
It is self-government. You govern yourself. You inspect. Why can't an association that the grocery stores go to join an association that certifies their food? Because government doesn't do it. Government is allowing genetically modified food into us, and we're getting all kinds of poisons that we don't know about that's protected and ordered by government.
I agree with you about that, Terrence, that the genetically modified food is bad, but But what you're suggesting just doesn't work. It never worked in history.
It has worked. It's just never been tried. You're not. It's a long process, and it's hard to educate the people when they've been indoctrinated into socialism and agree to socialism. But freedom means that I have to provide for myself.
Who says, Terrence, freedom means that we have a right to choose our own form of government? If we don't want what you want, we got a right to have a different kind of government.
As long as your government doesn't infringe upon me, you can't have a government that attacks me because that's what you want. That's a trespass against me. That enslaves me.
Every government trespasses on someone. What do you think the draft is? And the most people on the right wing are the most militaristic.
But that doesn't make it right. The draft is wrong. We should oppose it, and we should fight.
Government has traffic cops. Government has traffic lights. I mean, the reality is there's going to be government no matter what, and it's a question of what do we want that government to be doing?
The government is to protect your liberty, not to force liberty upon you.
But that's just what you say. Maybe I say the government is something else. Don't we have a democracy? Can't we collectively decide what the government is?
Democracy is mob rule.
All right. Well, if you're against democracy, I got nothing I can say about it. Terrence, I want to thank you for the call, and we got to move along. But thank you. Thank you very much. I'm not cutting you off because I disagree with you. I'm moving along because we got someone at the mic and someone on the phone. I'm going to take the phone guest first. We have Randall from Waveland. Randall, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
I spoke with you guys earlier, and I'm on my way over there now, but I was the one that said I was homeless for 12 years. And like I say, I got my life together and got a roof over my head for 2 years before this big storm hit, you know. And I do have a roof over my head now. It's not my roof. My roof is gone, but I do have a roof over my head, and I have the fear I'm going to be losing this roof real soon because of they haven't taken care of all the people that are fixing to be homeless in this town of Waveland, Bay St. Louis, Past Christian. They have a lot of people that are going to be homeless real soon here, and I have that fear because I know what it's like to be there. I was homeless for 12 years, and I have that fear of it happening real soon here.
Well, for the people listening in Canada or who just joined us on whatever station, Waveland, Bay St. Louis, and Past Christian are the three hardest hit communities by Hurricane Katrina in the country. They didn't get hit by a levee failure. They got hit by the storm, and they were just wiped out. And, Randall, I'm going to have to move on, but just tell people out there who are listening, is this area recovered?
Not even close. It hasn't even got 10% of what it needs.
Okay, some people say 20 to 30, but whatever it is, it ain't even halfway back, that's for sure.
No, not nowhere near 50%. Just as the rest of the country knows, we are still down here fighting for our lives.
Thank you very much, Randall. Thank you very much. Those numbers to call in again are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And at the microphone, we have Cricket, who is from Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. Welcome, Cricket, to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for being here. So you're from another one of the hardest-hit communities down
here. Yes. Actually, I moved over here 3 years before the storm, and I retired. Started a little business and had a little job and lived on the river, on Jordan River, behind Casino Magic. And it's amazing that what can be taken away from you in one day within a matter of hours. You know, yeah. We lost everything.
You had a business? What kind of business?
Personal chef business called the Food Fairy, where I cooked for private clients in their homes. And, of course, all the people that could afford that kind of a service are no longer here. You know, they're starting to build back, but nobody has the economic wherewithal to be able to afford that kind of a service anymore. I mean, we're struggling for our lives here. Everybody is. Like, I heard a caller earlier say, we're living week to week. I mean, and it's almost day to day. I just moved. I've been in a camper since Katrina.
A FEMA camper?
No.
Just a
FEMA lost my name. No, that's a whole story. I've got official documents where I fought FEMA because they lost me in the system because they umbrellaed me under another person's FEMA number. And I fought it, and I lost. I took it all the way pro bono from an attorney, D.L. Piper Association, up in New York. And they fought for me and took it all the way. And FEMA told me, you know, basically, tough luck. You're on your own. They had me in Louisiana. You know, they don't know what they're doing. I've got documents that you couldn't believe.
Now, I mean, for people who are just tuning in, because this is now already, I've lost track in the ninth hour of our broadcast. This has been the story all night. I mean, people down here, it's just been about bureaucracy. It's been like being on hold with a phone company for everything that you need to survive.
Yeah, you know, it's like after the storm, we had satellite TV, you know, and these people are calling and they want us to pay this bill. And they've got an $800 bill because it's a $700 disconnect fee. And I'm like, disconnect fee, you know, come down here. Your satellite is actually still attached to the house, but the house is up the street. You know, and on the ground. You want to charge me, you know, we fought this battle with the electric company and the water company and the TV company and the phone company. You know, I had to get official documents to show that I no longer had service as of 8/29/05, and they're still billing me at this point.
And you're not alone. I mean, everybody had this.
It's ridiculous.
And there was no, as I understand it, I wasn't here right after the storm. There was just no unified leadership down here to say, let's take care of all these problems.
No, and there still isn't. And what my point to the rest of the country is that we had this disaster here, okay? And the government failed us down here in numerous ways, which we're discussing tonight. But the point of the exercise is this is not the last disaster that's going to happen in this country. And the rest of the country needs to be made aware of what our government has done wrong, and they can't depend on the government, you know, to bail us out. We have to pull together as people, like the lady was saying about Cuba. I was really amazed about that, that Cuba will come in and you're guaranteed to have a home rebuilt if you lost your home. And right. That's a communist country, you know. So if they can do it, why can't we do it here? If it wasn't for the church groups here, we wouldn't be where we are. It's not the government that has gotten us here. It is the church and the volunteers that have come here and helped us. And we're a long way off from being where we were.
Where you were. Well, Cricket, can you stay at the mic for a couple minutes?
Sure.
I want to pass this around. We got callers, but let me ask Sherry and Paul. This business about instead of just getting help, you get bureaucracy. I mean, it's in the most extreme form down here in the Gulf, but is it really that different from what poor people face elsewhere?
No, it's criminal all over the country, where there's tons of dollars that are spent on doing 10-year studies on homelessness and why homelessness exists, and money spent on building more and more staff, coming up with terms like housing ready. I thought you were ready for a house if you didn't have one. Lots of crazy things like this. And but I, you know, I also do have to admit that some of the scandalous things that I've seen happen along the Gulf with money that should have been used to provide affordable housing for folks instead of a bunch of other garbage is criminal as well. But yeah, all across the country, you know, there's just like waste of money that's spent not, you know, doing the thing that needs to be done, which is, you know, provide decent jobs and build affordable housing.
Let me tell the people who are just tuning in or listening in Canada, you know, one of the things, the scandals down here, is that the governor of Mississippi basically impounded $600 million that had been designated for low-income housing, and he's spending it on vastly increasing the size of the port down here as a business venture, when there are still people without housing. So that's kind of a scandal. Those numbers to call in here on the Homelessness Marathon, we got calls stacked up, so I want to get to them, are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. We got Mario from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mario, are you there? Do we have Mario?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can, Mario. Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What would you like to say?
How's it going, man? I just wanted to say, in response to the guy that called one call before last, I want you to stop for a second and try to distinguish the difference between freedom and anarchy, because that's what government officials' jobs are. And if you think that their jobs are so easy, try to take that into consideration for a second. If there is no government, we live in an anarchy society.
But we got a lot of anarchists, too, who believe in that. I mean, a lot of people believe in anarchism, I must point out.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. And that'd be great if we, you know, we should all go buy a bunch of guns and just kill each other.
But I'm not sure that's what anarchism
is. Top, right?
Yeah.
Well, basically, that's what it'll turn into eventually.
I'm not an anarchist.
I mean, if you don't believe in government, then then the same people that don't believe that they want us to abolish government are the same people that talk about support our troops, right? Well, you don't think that military, our troops, our government?
I understand that. I just want to say
dollars pay for this war.
I just want to say that Terrence, who called us from Texarkana, he spoke for a lot of people. I wish I could have talked to him for longer. I mean, if he'd have called in another hour when we, you know, there were times we had more time to talk. But he spoke for a lot of people. A lot of people believe that the government should not have this kind of a role. And
Any kind of a role.
Well, you know, Grover Norquist said to shrink the government down to a size small enough you can drown it into in a bathtub. And
we really think that people are really good enough to where if everything was privatized, people would actually take it upon themselves to build the roads.
Well, let me tell you something. Let me just tell you something. I like to take baths, and I don't want my government in the tub with me. That's my view, you know. And we need a government. We need a government. That's my opinion. But that's just my opinion. We're showing this show to have a dialogue, so I'm glad Terrence called in.
And I don't think people give him enough credit for what they do. That's what I'm saying.
The government,
I mean, you know, these people have a really hard job. Just think for a second. Try to distinguish the difference between freedom and anarchy and tell me exactly what the difference is, because if you really think about it, there kind of isn't a difference when it comes down to it.
Well, you know.
What is freedom compared to anarchy?
I cannot be the one. I'm pro government, not pro big oppressive government. I'm pro government that serves the people. Sherry, you wanted to say?
Yeah, but I think what gets mixed up in this process is I think people aren't necessarily anti-government, but they're angry at their government because their government hasn't been doing what it needs to do, like rebuild Mississippi. That should be like a number one priority out there. And instead, you know, we're doing crazy things all over the country with our money.
Mario, I got to move along. I want to thank you very much for the call. But to continue the thought that Sherry is making, you know, there's ever been a family where you had a father who was a drunk and a child molester and a wife beater, and you had to get the police to take him out of the house. But that's not the same as being against fatherhood, you know. So we just have had a government that didn't do its job. That's my belief, but I'm that's just me. Numbers to call in are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Cece from Kiln, Mississippi. Cece, are you there?
Yes.
Well, Cece, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What's on your mind tonight?
Yeah, I'm Cece with WQRZ, and I had a few more things I really wanted to hit on.
Okay.
I didn't get a chance to earlier, and I'll make my point real quick.
Okay.
Other countries have like $9 and up minimum wage to meet the cost of living there. Why don't we have the same advantage? That's point one. Point two, a stimulus package should allow each state ability to take out of the stimulus just what they need, not what they want. Example, housing for everyone. Point three would be, this would be a challenge for President Obama. He should freeze all CEOs of big companies and banks for 5 years. And a cap on all wage earners over $100,000 a year, namely the lawyers, insurance companies, doctors, hospitals, as well as those trying to sue said businesses for excessive amounts. Come on, people, y'all. We need to get real. The government's not doing the best job they can be doing. Do the job the taxpayers elected you to do. We are your paycheck, and we've had enough.
Okay, Cece, I want to...
Sherry, I really want to take in... You and I are about on the same wavelength. You know, they are here to serve and protect us, and we really need to, down here on the coast, put a stop to businesses profiting over our loss or financial inabilities by multiplying and jacking up the prices in your stores. You know, this is what a disaster is, you know, and Sherry, you're right. It's scandalous, and it is a crime.
Cece, thank you very much for calling in, and thank you very much for sharing that with us. Unfortunately, Cricket had to leave the mic, but we have somebody else now at the mic. And your name, sir?
My name's Tracy.
Tracy.
Yes, sir.
And you are from where, Tracy?
I'm from Philadelphia.
Okay.
But I was living in Biloxi for about 5 years before the hurricane.
Okay.
And ever since the storm, I've been homeless and very unemployed. Off and on up until this point. Okay.
Okay. And where were you when Katrina hit?
Okay. I evacuated from Biloxi, Mississippi to Macomb, Mississippi to stay with family a week before the storm. And it was in Macomb, Mississippi that I sought help through FEMA. And I actually did have, I think they called it an investigator, and I had a case number. And I consider myself one of the people that slipped through the cracks. I got nothing. I never even got a food card. I got absolutely nothing.
And I've talked before on this as a broadcast that there's so many cracks for people to slip through around here. It seems like there's more cracks than there are solid anything, really.
Right. So all my stuff was approved by the field person, the investigator, and the man in the office in Macomb, Mississippi, would not fax a simple piece of paper that he was supposed to fax. He said he had to send it through to their general. And it was at that time that was the last I've heard anything.
Now, where were you living before Katrina hit?
I stayed at the Seagull Motel on Highway 90.
So were you on welfare before it hit?
No, sir. I was working through a able body.
Okay, so you were working and you were staying in a motel.
Yes, sir.
As your lodging. It wasn't because you'd been placed there. That was where you were living.
Yeah, that's where I lived.
And you were doing manual labor at that time.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, after Katrina, were you able to get work?
No. After Katrina, I didn't get any work. I stayed with my family for a while. There wasn't much going on in Macomb. And Macomb, Mississippi, was also slightly affected by the storm. Not as bad here, but what I did was I came back to Biloxi, and I cried. I stayed about 3 days. There was nowhere for me to stay. I slept outside. I couldn't get into even a tent. They just basically what they said is, well, that's on you, and go wherever you can go.
How long after Katrina did you come back to this area?
It was, I say, my first time, it was about 5 months.
Okay. And was the motel still there?
No, it was gone.
It was gone, just like everything else.
Everything,
right?
Everything that I knew was gone. It just was gone. Just spots.
I know people just can't really believe it unless you see it down here. I want to understand something, because people will ask this. Wasn't there a lot of work for reconstruction and stuff? Weren't there a lot of people hiring to do building and stuff down here?
Well, see, that's what we believed, and that's what I was led to believe, and my family believed that, and that's why they suggested that I just go back to Biloxi so I could support and take care of myself. And actually, there were just people driving around. That's all. All I saw was contractors just driving around. The temp agency wasn't open yet, and there wasn't anything going on. And I was told that it's going to get better. They're waiting for funding, was what I was told. As soon as they get this funding, then it'll be plenty of work again. So I had to leave.
So the rebuilding didn't start right away. They were waiting for insurance, waiting for funding, waiting for whatever it was.
That's what I was told.
And there were a lot of unemployed people, of course, competing for the few jobs that there might have been.
Yes, sir.
So yep. That was the problem you found.
Yeah.
And what is your situation today?
My situation today still is basically the same, because ever since that happened, I haven't had a long-term resident or study employment. I drifted up to Pensacola, and then I went to Fort Walton Beach, Florida, and everywhere I went, they have papers, and they asked that question, was your life affected by the hurricane? And I was responding with a yes, but I was just treated as you're poor, you're unemployed, and you're homeless now, and actually, we don't want you here. And Fort Walton, they didn't want me in Pensacola because I had nowhere to stay. There was no long-term lodging.
That's funny, because, Paul, aren't there communities all over this country that are just screaming out, sending us more poor, unemployed people?
Sure. Yeah. There's lots of them out there.
That's what they want, right? So you've heard this kind of story before, right? That I mean, I'm not talking about Katrina now, but if you're poor, they don't want you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a whole slew of laws that have been put on the books across the country that are designed specifically to remove poor people. And I think what's most outrageous about the governor stealing that $600 million, about the way people are being treated down here, it's not that money didn't come down here. It's that the politicians and the corporations stole it. You know, Jackson should have been indicted when he was the head of HUD, and they caught him giving hundreds of millions of dollars to his buddies, you know, under the guise of helping the people down here. And we continue to question the people about what's going on. We continue to show anger and frustration, but we don't see our government responding with indictments and with lawsuits against the people that stole the money that was supposed to go to help the people that live here.
Same thing happened under Sam Pierce in the Reagan administration. They stole the money from the poor box.
Yeah, and I want to chime in on this as well, because Paul used an important word, human. You know, the psychological impact. I know myself as a formerly homeless mother, and, you know, I don't talk a whole lot about it, but just the psychological impact and devastation of living in a freezing, abandoned HUD property for 9 months, wondering if I was going to freeze to death with my son, that experience alone has some serious psychological impact on a person, and in particular their kid. Now, with all the research and stuff that's coming out now in terms of the absolute psychological impact on the folks that suffered and experienced Katrina, of one night going to bed and then the next morning waking up and losing everything, losing loved ones, losing memories, photographs, you know, your entire livelihood, and then being told, like, you've got to go get your life together. You've got to go get a job, and there's no jobs that exist anymore. The bureaucratic crap that everybody has had to deal with down here, and the fact that the media has totally made Mississippi invisible, is just absolutely appalling. And I think that, you know, programs like this bring the human beings back into the picture.
Excuse me. How many programs like this are there?
None.
Thank you very much. I rest my case. By the way, I, of course, spoke to your son outside the RNC not so long ago, and he says, as of course you know, as his mother, that he still feels he's recovering from the trauma of what he went through being homeless as a child. It doesn't heal overnight. And Tracy, you know, I'm sure you know that you are, you know, you're going through a difficult process now, and it's not going to go away instantly. But we all would here wish for you to get a job and get into a good situation.
Well, I didn't have much, but I would like to have the life that I did have back. At least I was able to support myself and work study and keep a roof over my head. And as far as being homeless goes, and another thing really comes to mind is people have a tendency to stereotype. They think that if you are in that situation, you're a drug addict, alcoholic. And actually, that was not the case before the hurricane. And that somewhat became the case as time went on. But I never received any counseling. Like I say, I came back to Biloxi, Mississippi 3 different times. And it did affect me in a hurting way, too, because I cried. Places that I knew and loved and went to every single day was just gone. And there was no work. And people kept saying, just come back here. Just come back here. Just come back here. And every time I would come back here, I would be told by a law enforcement or something that you have to leave. Mm-hmm. You ain't got no property. You're not working. You have to go. And staying in abandoned buildings was really and still isn't my thing, but I'm trying to get back on my feet. And one of my questions was, although that happened some time ago, I did have a number, and is there anything that I can do? Because they said that I was supposed to get $2,000. That's what they approved me for, and I never got a dime. And that money would help me greatly right now to get started again. Now that work for me is picking up. And I just wondered if there was anything that I could do about that now.
Well, after this show, we can get over to the corner and we can talk. We'll put you in touch with some of the folks from the Mississippi Justice Center, as well as there's a chapter of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign that's going to get started in Waveland, Mississippi.
And in the meantime, we just want to thank you very much for coming and giving your heartfelt story here at the mic, here on the Homelessness Marathon. And we want to wish you Godspeed and all the best in getting back on your feet.
Okay, thanks for having me. I appreciate this.
Thank you very much. All right, those numbers to call in again here, 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Do we still have Betty from Hawaiian Gardens, California on the phone? Betty, are you there? I'm not hearing Betty, so I don't know if we have Betty. Okay, well, do we have anybody on the phone?
Hello?
Hello, Betty, you are there.
I am here.
Okay, Betty, welcome to the welcome to the Homelessness Marathon, Betty.
Oh, thank you. You guys have been doing a great job.
Well, thank you very much. What would you like to say tonight?
I would like to say that I've been thinking about, you know, Martin Luther King got killed just before the Poor People's March.
Yeah.
And I can't remember that the Poor People's March ever took place.
I can't.
But I think it's time for one.
Well, Sherry here is one of the people who's trying to reinvent the Poor People's March, and there's others as well who are doing that.
Oh, good for Sherry.
But I'll tell you this, you know, one of the interesting things to me, and I'd like to get Paul and Sherry's opinion, Martin Luther King was moving away from race, in a way, and moving towards the general issue of poverty and not just about race. Not that it isn't important, but it seems to me...
Yeah, they took him out, too.
Yeah, they took him out. That seemed to be crossing a line.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the left, it seems to me, has been moving in the opposite direction. The left in the United States, it seems to me, has been moving away from dealing with poverty and being concentrated more on race, as if that was everything. So, you know, I'm wondering what has happened to the concept of an anti-poverty movement here in the United States.
That's what I've been wondering. And to me, race and poverty and homelessness and all of this stuff is all wrapped up in pretty much a big blanket. But there isn't any blanket.
Well, let me have my distinguished panelists here answer this.
Well, that's what we're trying to do. The Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign is trying to pick up where Dr. Martin Luther King left off and build a multiracial army of the poor across the country. And actually, on July 16th through the 19th, we have a national conference, and we dare to say that we're having a national conference to end poverty. We're calling it Building the Unsettling Force, and that's what we intend to do.
Well, that's great. Great minds run in the same direction.
Yeah. I hope you can join us or at least bring up our website and figure out how to get involved.
Okay, I'll keep listening.
Betty, thank you very much for the call. Those numbers again, 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Do we still have Sean on the line? No, I'm going to wait.
Hello?
Hi, Sean. What would you like to say, Sean?
This is so cool. I get to speak on the same hour as Sherry Honkola.
Yeah,
wow.
And Paul Bowden. And let's not forget me, you know.
Yeah, well, she was on a documentary. The other two I haven't seen on a documentary.
Well, there should be. Those will be coming out soon.
Okay. I hope this gets on YouTube, by the way. I hope I'm not stepping on anybody's toes. But I'm not anywhere where I can see this on video, and I'd love to see this on video.
Well, I don't even know if we got our webcams going, because the Free Speech Television folks have gone. There might be a webcam. I, as the mere host of the show, I don't even know myself. But anyway, Sean.
Oh, next year, I hope that you can arrange for it, the whole run to be on YouTube. That would be awesome.
You know, the whole thing was supposed to be televised this year, but Free Speech Television ran into some issues with funding, and just like General Motors, I think actually they're doing better than General Motors, but they're not getting bailed out. So, you know, that was one of the things that held us back. Anyway, Sean, I ought to move on, but have you got anything, last comment you want to make?
Yeah. First of all, when someone abuses you, be it slavery, police brutality, they're doing it for the same reason that people break the speed limit, because they feel they can. That's the only reason. And you'll get told, oh, it's because of this reason, it's because of that, it's because of the other. It's just because they feel they can. And the earlier caller needs to know the difference between anarchy and anocracy, A-N-O-C-R-A-C-Y. Anocracy is societal breakdown. The meltdown where everybody gets a shotgun and starts killing each other. That's anocracy. That's not anarchy. Any good anarchist will tell you that. And the question that I had for both you and Sherry Honkola is, A, do you see any low-hanging fruit among the problems that we have? And B, do you see any what are called synergy points, where if you solve one problem, one or two or three or more other problems become easier to solve.
Okay, let me toss this first to Paul. Low-hanging fruit, I assume you mean, are there any easy problems to solve right now to win?
Yeah.
Let me toss it to Paul. Thank you very much for the call, Sean. Sean, Paul, what do you say? Any low-hanging fruit? We're not talking about, we're not talking about agriculture here.
No, I know what we're talking about. I really do. I mean, I think that building the first phase of the civil rights movement where you're incorporating actual legal representation for people like what this gentleman was talking about earlier, for the people that are being harassed by the cops, and you combine that with community organizing, is you start to build the base. I mean, we're not going to get to a Martin Luther King. He didn't create it. It created him. There was a movement that was going on at the local level, that was community meetings, that was church meetings, that was in the parks, that was in the concert halls, that was art, that was music. And that creates a Martin Luther King. It's not the other way around. And I think that is the change that is starting to happen. I think that's what the rap organizations are trying to do out on the West Coast, the Western Regional Advocacy Project. You connect it to the national movement like Sherry's group, and then you'll start to see the change. But the low-hanging fruit is us, and we can always get together amongst ourselves, and we can start connecting the criminalization of mentally ill people.
I'm taking such a beating. Are you calling me a low-hanging fruit? What the heck did I do, you know? Oh, never mind.
But you have to understand, I mean, when 60% of the people in our local jails are mentally ill people, and when 75% of them were homeless at the time that they were incarcerated, you are talking about a human rights issue.
I agree
and
with you
about are
that.
Talking about local jail, so it's a local issue, and we can stop it when we get together amongst ourselves and get entitled enough to say, hell no, we're not going to take it anymore.
We just got time. Let's quickly take another call. We got Henry from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Henry, are you there? Do we have Henry? Okay, I don't know if we have Henry or not. I guess we don't have Henry. We do have Henry. By the way, the webcam is still up, folks, at www.homelessnessmarathon.org if you want to see our smiling faces or our tired faces or whatever. So we don't have Henry, I guess. We lost him. All right, we got only 2 minutes left or something, so I want to get a kind of closing statement from both Paul and Sherry. Where do we go from here? Paul?
We go to Louisville, Kentucky, from July 16th through the 19th, and we start building a national movement, and then we report back on this show next year about the low-hanging fruit that we've all been eating.
Sherry?
That sounds great. I just also want to encourage folks that we're trying to teach people, if you're interested in how to take over abandoned government-owned properties to house folks, or set up homeless encampments, or how to take over your local sheriff's offices to stop foreclosures, give us a call, because it's time for us to not just say we want human rights, but to reclaim them.
Well, you guys, we're so brief. We've actually got a few more seconds. What does organizing mean to you, Paul?
It means building the sense of entitlement. I mean, I don't believe that power is going to give us anything, and I don't believe that what is missing in this country is a lack of charity. I think that you get what you deserve when you demand what it is that you're entitled to. And we are entitled to housing, we are entitled to health care, and we are entitled to a quality education, because we are human beings first and foremost.
Your website for your organization, quick?
WRAPHOME.org, raphome.org.
And Sherry, the website for your organization?
www.economichumanrights.org.
And we got about 10 seconds. Sherry, what does organizing mean to you?
It means saving our lives and us stepping forward and beginning to love ourselves and love each other and build the kind of community and country that we want to have.
All right. And here, speaking as one of the low-hanging fruit, I want to say that what it means to me anyway is at least let's be grateful that we still have the right to have free speech in this country. And as long as we got it, let's keep on speaking out. And we'll come back after a short break.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with Community Radio WQRZ of Waveland, Mississippi. The opinions expressed in this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. To order CDs of this broadcast or to contact the Homelessness Marathon, go to homelessnessmarathon.org.